6 replicants. 3 male, 3 female. They slaughtered 20.
A Blade Runner's job is to hunt down replicants. Manufactured humans you can't tell from the real thing.
What's this?
Roy Batty. Probably the leader.
There was just one outfit making replicants that superhuman. The Terrell Corporation.
On today's episode, we are discussing Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick, the book that inspired the movie Blade Runner. There are spoilers ahead, but don't worry. Androids are welcome. We're inclusive like that. So, let's get this party started. Hi! This is Maria Blackheart, and welcome to the Misfit Book Club, a podcast for readers, robots, replicants, weirdos, blue stockings, normals, bounty hunters, and every type of bookish person in between. This is episode 16, and I'm here with my co-host, Pixie Burger.
Hello, Maria.
Sorry. That was amazing.
No, it wasn't.
I loved it.
That was my robot voice, guys. I'm doing okay. How are you doing? This has been kind of a crazy month for us.
Yes, I'm also doing okay. I'm okay that we're okay.
Same. Survival is like as good as it's going to get for me this month, I think. So I'm happy to be there.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. I am particularly cranky because I am in the process of trying to give up sugar. And it is, of course, the Passover / Easter season. And there is nothing but sugar everywhere, including these jelly beans that you got me addicted to like 3 years ago.
Starburst jelly beans.
I will eat half a bag in a sitting. And then for some reason, it like burns my tongue. But that doesn't stop me.
There has to be some science out there, you guys, about why sour candy sets your tongue on fire. There's definitely science about sugar being, what, like 8 times more addictive than cocaine?
I fell off the wagon today. I was like, I've been doing pretty good for the past week. And then today I had 3 cookies. I mean, back to back to back. I didn't even come up for air.
Well, it's the perfect time of year for basically falling off the wagon because it's still cold where I am. There's nothing else to do except just hole up in your house and eat. Mm-hmm. This may sound controversial, but I feel like Easter candy is the best candy.
It is the best candy.
Better than Halloween, which is just any candy. So I feel you. I'm having my own problems with sugar this week.
So anyway, I'm a little down in the dumps because I'm trying to be healthy. And I did not anticipate how tough it was going to be.
Well, I had kind of started out the new year telling myself that I was going to be healthier, too. And then another one of my sort of resolutions was I was going to try online dating again, which has not happened either. Okay, it's not a pleasant experience. I've never enjoyed it. And I've been on so many bad dates at this point that I'm like, why did I even tell myself I wanted to do this again? But I did match with someone that I didn't wind up even reaching out to. But I thought that I would read this guy's Bumble profile for the pod because it's kind of relevant. So the guy is super nerdy, but I don't care. And this is what he says in his profile. PhD in computer science, scientist, artist, 5'11". I make robots for a living. Are you ready for the apocalypse?
No.
And that's all he had to say. And I swiped right. And we matched. But then, of course, I didn't reach out to him because I never do. That's just a horrible thing that I do.
Also, are you ready for the apocalypse is maybe the worst best pickup line I've ever heard.
It was super handy sounding to me. I was like, huh, I kind of could use that. That's where I am. That's the low point that I'm at right now when it comes to my dating life.
You should be like, do you do floors? Because I've got a house. Are you Bob Vila? Swipe right.
Anyway, it was at least unique. I could use that as well, guys. Anybody who's out there, holler at me. We're on Twitter.
Pixie, if you find love through this podcast, I will be so sad that we can't ever tell anyone. Yeah, okay, so good luck, Mr. Bumble, sir, in your search for a woman to ride the apocalypse out with. We are very sorry that it won't be Pixie, but I'm sure you will find the perfect doomsday prepper for your bunker.
he gets points for being creative and different. At least it's not a picture of a guy holding a gun, which seems to be a thing that guys around here really, really like to do in their profile pictures on the dating apps.
Awesome.
So,
well,
great, great month for us.
Actually, so we have a little bit of podcast housekeeping. This is our very first like podcasty related announcement in a while, I think. So we have had a discussion group on Goodreads, and I'm sure this surprises all of you because none of you are there. All of our discussions happen on Twitter and Instagram, and we really love having them there. So we are going to close that down. So that is our announcement. Now, having said that, you can still be friends with us on Goodreads. So type in our email address, misfitbookclubpodcast@gmail.com. We'll pop up, friend us on there. We rate books. We write reviews. You know, all the things you would expect from a Goodreads friend, but we're just not going to keep the discussion boards open. So
it's interesting to figure out what mediums are working for us and which ones aren't. And Goodreads just isn't working. So it's okay to say goodbye for now.
All right. So that brings us to book news for this month. Our first piece of book news actually comes from Barnes & Noble. So Barnes & Noble just released an app called Browsery. And it is like a combination, like book suggestion, social media network. So the way it works is you hop on Browsery and you ask a question like, I just finished Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? What should I read next? And then people in the community respond with book suggestions. And then kind of like on Reddit, you can upvote the books that you agree with. So the most voted on books go to the top of the list. I think it's really an interesting concept because I know that you and I are fantastic book recommenders, but sometimes there's a book that I want to read and I don't know who to ask for a suggestion. So like just recently I was trying to find a funny, uplifting book for a friend of mine who's going through a kind of a hard time. And it occurred to me that I don't read those. So I don't know where to find them. And so I think Browsery would be a really good place to ask those sorts of questions and get really high quality suggestions.
I love that idea. It's fun to connect with readers anywhere, right? And you'd mentioned that this kind of reminds you of a Reddit thread. I'm going to have to check it out. I haven't checked out Browsery yet.
Yeah, it's on Android and iOS. So equal opportunity book suggestions there.
Very nice.
And speaking of book suggestions, a book that we definitely don't recommend that you read is Sean Penn's new book. So Pixie mentioned this many, many episodes ago that he was coming out with a book called Bob Honey Who Just Do Stuff. And the reviews are out.
It sounds awful. Claire Fallon published a review in Huffington Post that is scathing, and it doesn't even have to be scathing because the excerpts that they published of the book are so bad that it pretty much speaks for itself. So don't waste your time, guys, reading Sean Penn's book. Sounds awful.
Yeah. So Claire Fallon said, this is all apparently supposed to seem deeply witty and profound. Instead, it's akin to the product of a postmodern literature bot. It doesn't seem quite possible that a human person wrote this mess.
I don't understand this preoccupation people have with like big words and alliteration and just trying too hard, I guess, because that doesn't guarantee anything. You know, it's a lot harder to say something really important with fewer words than with big, complicated, many words. You know,
I 100% agree. This was true when we were grading student papers, when we were professors.
Yeah.
You could always tell who had become desperate at, you know, 11:50 p.m. before their paper was due by the size of the words that started cropping up,
right?
Because they were using the thesaurus, right? They're like, these big words are going to make me sound so smart.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always circling them and being like, this doesn't mean what you think it means.
No.
I actually have two sentences from the book that are alliterative and terrible I thought I would share.
Okay.
And one is, dreams died like destiny's deadwood. What does that even mean?
It's awful.
And the second terrible sentence is, Scottsdale's dry climate contradicts the clammy calcedent of New Guinean condensation. I actually think it's like coalescent I've never even heard that word, and I have a PhD. Like, where did he find it?
The thesaurus, like you said. He just, like, looked it up and started playing with C words. I don't know. It just speaks to this larger problem with publishing, that if you already have a name, you get a platform even when you don't deserve it. And there are a lot of writers with a lot of skill who never, ever get the opportunities like Sean Penn has to publish a book, and they deserve them so much more.
Basically, Sean Penn can go get lit.
Yeah.
He's gross, and his book is bad, and I don't feel bad about it.
I will keep my eyes open for a good review of that book, just because I think it will be interesting to read one if one comes out. Anyway. Well, other book news is I feel like we're really cutting edge these days, Maria, because everybody's starting book clubs like us.
Copycats.
I know. So this seemed really weird to me, but Barnes & Noble is starting a book club. And I'm like, wait a second. Barnes & Noble didn't already have a book club? That's weird.
How's that possible?
I don't know. So anyway, that just happened, I guess, this year.
Huh.
It's things like that that make me kind of just scratch my head a little bit. But I mean, I guess good on them.
Mm-hmm.
Also, BuzzFeed is going to have a book club starting this summer, which I'm actually excited about because they've brought in Maris Kreitzman, who is a wonderful literary critic, to head it up. So I'm excited for that. So Maris was at the Book of the Month as a judge, but no longer. And now she's working for BuzzFeed. And her book that she wrote is called Slaughterhouse 90210. And it's so great because basically what she did with this Tumblr, I guess, I think it was a Tumblr, was she paired pop culture images or GIFs or things like that with lines from much more literary work in profound ways. It's really great. So I'll take a look at it. It's kind of up our alley, really.
Good. Well, I like her.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm excited to see what she does with the BuzzFeed Book Club.
Me too.
She also has the cutest dog named Busy, a pug.
Yeah. And her husband is a comedian named Josh who writes for John Oliver. So
that's the book news for this month. So now we get to start talking about Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. Which, I don't know what I expected, but I'm interested in what you thought of it. Do you want to start?
Sure. I didn't know what to expect either. I was really excited because I like reading outside of my comfort zone, and this definitely was that. It was hard. Mm-hmm. I will say it got easier, I think. It started off a bit difficult for me, a little hard to get into, but the longer I read, I understood more of where the story was going and got more used to the writing style, and it got easier. But for a short book, I think it was still pretty challenging.
Yeah, and I guess this is true confession time.
Mm-hmm.
We chose the book because it was short, and we were hoping to catch a little bit of a break there. And about 50 pages in, I was like, we've made a terrible mistake, because I felt the same way. So one of the things that, not to brag, but I have a pretty good sense of taste. And that doesn't mean that my taste is right. When I read something, I have a pretty immediate reaction about whether I think it's good or not. And so when I started reading Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, I was like, okay, this is good.
Mm.
Like, this is really quality. But sometimes something being good means that it's going to be really challenging. And that's exactly what this book was for me. It's just dense.
It was
dense. In terms
dense.
Of the themes and Philip K. Dick does not spoon feed you anything. I don't know how you feel about it.
No, definitely. It was a challenge. I think our idea to read a shorter book definitely backfired. It was a good challenge. And I don't know about you, but I like books that make me ask questions. And this one definitely made me. And I even like books that make me feel disoriented. And that's definitely part of the style of Philip K. Dick's writing. But also just the story itself is you don't really know what's happening at all times. And I think that's the point, right?
Yeah.
Rick,
I agree.
Doesn't know what's going on, and neither do we. So we're just along for that crazy mind ride with him.
I did think at multiple points, I was like, this man did a lot of drugs.
Maybe.
In this book, basically the world has gotten blown up by nuclear weapons in World War Terminus. And nuclear fallout is still happening. And basically, most animals are dead and people have congregated in cities to try and survive. And everyone who was healthy has already immigrated to like off-world colonies on Mars and other, you know, planets. And everyone left on Earth is basically like either too sick or too poor to get off the planet. And so that, I think, is, you know, okay. I mean, that seems like pretty run-of-the-mill post-apocalyptic kind of narrative. But the stuff that gets kind of nuts are the social constructs.
Mm-hmm.
So people value live animals pretty much over any other form of life. One, because they're rare, but two, because they think it gives them a greater sense of empathy, because empathy is what separates them from these humanoid androids that they've made to serve off-world countries. And so that stuff gets really complex really fast.
Definitely. How do you feel about that idea that empathy is the thing that distinguishes humans from other creations?
Man, I don't know.
Same, but I do like to ask that question. And I think he explores it really well when Rick meets Phil,
mm-hmm.
right? And Phil doesn't really seem to have a whole lot of empathy, but Rick maybe has some for androids and Phil doesn't have any for androids. And so there seems to be even a sliding scale there. And I think right. that is true that certain human beings have more than others. I mean, when you talk about those strengths finder tests, empathy is a strength or a weakness, right? And some people have tons of it and some people don't have any at all. And of course, completely lacking it, what does that make you? A sociopath? Yeah. So, and obviously those exist. You know, it's maybe a pat answer for some people, but it's not a satisfying one for Dick.
And I think he questions like how valid our empathy is if we can't have empathy for non-human things.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the interesting points in this book is that Earthlings value animals and animal life pretty much above both human life and android, mm-hmm. quote unquote, life. Dick is saying, oh, well, we value empathy above everything else. But like, if you can't have empathy for everything around you, what good is empathy at all?
Well, and this question really interested me a lot just because it showed up in my dissertation.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the books that I studied from the 19th century really praised and valued sympathy and empathy as these kind of core values and mm-hmm. practices. Like if you could sympathize with other people, then you could make the world better. But what happens in the 20th century is people start saying, well, there are limits to that. Right? Because you can sympathize with someone all day long and your behavior doesn't change. So what is the point of having those feelings if they cannot be converted into action of some sort? And so I just loved that question. Why do we think empathy is important? Why do we value it? Is it important? What are its limits, et cetera?
Yeah. And I kind of wondered if that was just kind of arbitrary. Too. Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly the androids lack empathy, but I wonder if, you know, humans just latched onto that one thing to make themselves feel superior to these other creatures in the way that we do all the time. I mean, what is racism if not latching onto something arbitrary, you know, someone's skin color
mm-hmm.
to try and say, I'm better than you.
Right. I loved how important animals were in the story because that added a separate layer of meaning to everything, both real and android animals.
I have to admit that took me aback. And I guess because I'd seen Blade Runner before I'd read the book and animals don't really factor into Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
Like when that kept popping up over and over again, I was like, what is this? I don't know what's going on.
Right.
But I liked it too.
And that's basically how we begin the book is with Rick with his android pet mm-hmm. looking at his neighbor who has a real horse, you know, and how much he just covets that horse and why, like, why does it matter so much in this world where everything is so bleak and awful that he wants not just a pet, but a real pet? Fascinating to me.
In a lot of ways, animals are the purest among us, right? Their motivations are, I mean, maybe that's part of it, or having something that depended on you. The other thing that isn't really addressed in the book, but you get the sense of it, is that people aren't really reproducing. You know, it's not quite as hopeless as Children of Men,
mm-hmm.
where like literally there are no children
right.
at all.
Yeah.
Anywhere. You get the sense that these creatures may be surrogates in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Something to care for.
That's an excellent point. And kind of this natural human desire to nurture, to be needed as part of some sort of biological instinct. I don't know.
The thing that made me think about like the child
mm-hmm.
thing was that toward the end of the book, Decker buys a goat.
Right.
He just like goes and buys a goat, which I find those horrible creatures. So I would never buy a real goat. Like, I just hate them. And so anyway, he said, and maybe we can have a kid.
Aww,
right.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Like the play on the word.
Yep.
And of course, Deckard wears this like metal codpiece to try and keep his like
junk safe. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, I don't think that's our number one problem here, but whatever.
But it all just speaks to the bleakness of the picture that Philip K. Dick is drawing of the future. And that to me is so fascinating. One of our favorite books that we've talked about a lot on the pod is The Road. And so I kept thinking about The Road so many times whenever they would mention the dust, just kind of this gray radioactive matter falling on everything. The world is turned to ashes.
Right. And I think that is part of why it's so important that this book is set in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
So historically in American culture, the West has been a place of great promise, right? Great potential. You could go west. You could go find a piece of land and make something of yourself. You can escape your past on the East Coast and become something new where nobody knows your name. And so that frontier, that Western frontier, has always been this really hopeful area of the U.S., even now, right? Everybody's mm-hmm. like, maybe California will save us. Well, California has all of its own problems, but we still think about it as this like land of sun and beaches and beautiful Hollywood types, right?
And technology.
Yeah, that too. Mm-hmm. Silicon Valley. And so I think it's really telling that the West, the San Francisco of Philip K. Dick's book, is hopeless.
Even it has been totally wrecked.
That tied into my dissertation, mm-hmm. which is about the frontier. So who knew?
It really did hit on tons of topics. What did you think about the androids? How did you feel about them while you were reading?
Oh, I was very sympathetic to them mm-hmm. until the end of the book. Backing up, the androids are basically slaves. So they can think and reason and form attachments and have an understanding of a sense of self. Like, they might be programmed, but they think of themselves as an I.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically are owned by people on Mars and forced to do really, really hard labor to build a colony where people shouldn't be living. Right. So androids are leaving these outside places to try and come to Earth and find some freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So in that respect, I was incredibly sympathetic to them.
Mm-hmm.
But then at the end of the book, there's this scene where they're all torturing a spider. And that's when I was like, oh, well, like, this is kind of the problem, right? That all seems unnecessarily cruel.
Right.
What did you think?
Well, you know, I think about this constantly. About artificial intelligence. I mean, yes. I see exactly what you're saying, and I agree. I also feel like any flaws within some sort of android, or Andy, as the book refers to them, is because of something a human being did in their system, right? Or maybe a flaw in them is not necessarily a flaw that was introduced intentionally, but it's just an offshoot of a flaw of humanity. So you can also look at those things and be like, well, the reason we dislike them are perfectly applicable to human beings as well. And so I love the way that the water gets super, super muddy as soon as you start thinking about it that way. And it, like, if they are monstrous creatures, whose fault is that? We made them. And also, who made us? Like, is it our fault? Like, it just goes so far down this crazy rabbit hole that I basically can't get out of it.
Well, we have talked about this question, not on the podcast, but together, especially in relation to Westworld, which I think messed both of us up.
Yeah.
And that is this question of, what obligations does a creator have to its created? So, you know, don't we kind of have an obligation to take care of the thing that we've made, especially when the thing can think and feel and reason? If we're going to make AI, and I'm not just talking about the androids in this book, but any kind of AI that can reason, like, don't we then have some kind of obligation to take care of it, whatever that looks like?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't let parents neglect their children. They are the creators of their children, which are created. Don't we have the same kind of obligation to any sentient thing that we create?
I think that's a question that a lot of people are finally beginning to ask. You know, this is 50 years ago that this book came out. So the fact that we're only now, I guess, within the last few years, starting to actually even talk about that question is pretty fascinating to me. I think the answer is yes, but I don't know even really how I've arrived at that answer. A sort of morality that I couldn't even really explain.
And this is the question that Westworld brings up. Because it's unclear to me whether the androids in this book are, like, if they're biological. But in Westworld, the robots are basically biological, mm-hmm. and are then programmed mentally, right?
Yeah, right.
And so I think Westworld even makes this question harder, because if it can bleed, if it has organs, if it can live and die, do we have an obligation to treat that thing less like a thing and more like a person? In other words, the question is, and this is the question that the book asks, is should androids have rights? Are they possessions that should be treated however you want to treat them because you bought it?
Well, it comes back to the really difficult question of what it means to be a human, because we have a shifting definition of what that means as well. Right. If you go back mm-hmm. in time, you look at many moments in history where human beings were classified as less than, as subhuman, and they had fewer rights because our definition of what it means to be a full human being changes. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a thing that a lot of people take for granted. But when it comes to rights, I think most of us are on board with the fact that humans are probably on a similar plane of existence, but there are even people still today who think that some people deserve more rights than others. So it's a hard question to even come at talking about androids, which would be things that we have made, when we can't even easily answer that question on our own biological plane. Does that make sense?
I immediately go back to, like, the Constitution that said Black people were 3/5 of a person.
Mm-hmm.
And now we look back on that and we're...
Well, that not, you know, yeah, not even that far back.
Yeah.
Were they 3/5 of a person? And all of these different pseudo-scientific definitions were used to justify slavery.
You know, we treat other humans who are undeniably human as less based on totally arbitrary criteria, whether it's the color of your skin or the amount of money you make,
mm-hmm.
or, you know,
your gender, your sexual orientation. Mm-hmm.
So how on earth are we ever going to be able to do anything with androids that's even remotely like fine?
And I don't think the book gives us easy answers on these questions. And
no,
that's okay. I don't think that's the point of science fiction, really.
No.
I think it introduces more than it answers. But, and we definitely found that to be true when we did Jurassic Park earlier. I came across this article that Adrian McKenzie wrote this month. He is a crime novelist, an Irish kind of cop novelist, and he loves Philip K. Dick. And this is from this article that he wrote, and I'll tweet the link out to our followers. He said, Philip K. Dick doesn't give us any answers either, except for the vague but possibly deep idea that the meaning of life is to be found in the search for the meaning of life. The best we can do is to strive for the truth, although we are constantly reminded to be wary, for falsity is everywhere.
Wow.
It's basically the most unsatisfying thing I've ever read. Like, he doesn't answer anything for you. You don't figure anything out. You aren't going to understand it, but it's worth the time.
That's effing. I mean, if I wanted to hear that, I'd just go to therapy. Like, that's basically what my therapist tells me all the time. I'm like, well, this sucks. And she's like, we just have to learn to be comfortable with our uncomfortable feelings. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, but how do I do that? And she's like, you just have to be, raise your tolerance level. And I'm like, none of these are answers.
They're just coping mechanisms, basically.
Exactly.
It's very easy to see how Philip K. Dick was a troubled person, because these were the questions that he was asking all the time. And if he sat with them long enough to write 30 something books, then I get it, because they're hard and they will drive you crazy, because I don't know that there are easy answers to any of them.
No, there aren't. And so that makes me kind of more impressed with Blade Runner, the movie, than I was in the past. Because now that I've read the source material, I appreciate like how difficult adapting it must have been mm-hmm. for Ridley Scott. Even though I think that the movie and the book deal with considerably different themes, or they deal with similar themes in considerably different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I think Blade Runner is much more concerned with capitalism
Agreed.
Than the book.
Yeah. Right. It's more, this one is definitely more post-apocalyptic.
Yes.
Than Blade Runner.
Which is more cyberpunk.
You could call it that, yeah.
I also feel like Blade Runner owes more of a legacy to like noir, mm-hmm. film noir, than you get out of the book, right?
So
Deckard, as played by Harrison Ford, my other boyfriend,
mm-hmm.
Is a very Dick Tracy kind of character, right?
Right
out of the Maltese Falcon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very dark, noir kind of, you know, Sin City-esque feel, even though Sin City comes after, obviously. But, you know, there's a different, it's pulling from a different heritage than the book is pulling from.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, at the end of the day, they're both interested in, you know, what do we do with androids that look like people?
Right. I wonder, and I don't know enough about Philip K. Dick to answer this question, so I'm really just wondering aloud. Like, is he writing more about humans in this book and like humanity and defining humanity than androids? And we're just fully seeing the actual impact of it now, that this sort of technology is much more common, much more likely for our future. Like, we're probably going to see people living on Mars.
I can't even possibly wrap my head around that.
Yeah. I mean, we're so much closer to that technology that we have a different take on it than maybe even he would as a writer.
I hadn't thought about that, but I think that's really smart. We have Sophia the robot, who I don't like. So I think that says something about me, right? I'm not like, oh, Sophia, that's so cool. I'm like, burn it with fire. I do not like her. At least give her a wig, for God's sake, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's very interesting to me, that reaction, because in talking about this on the podcast, I can be very cerebral and say, well, if it thinks and if it feels like, you know, maybe it should have rights. And then I look at Sophia the robot and I'm like, if I had a sledgehammer in 5 minutes, I'd take care of this whole problem.
I mean, there's a reason I don't have an Alexa in my house. I'll just say that. Many
reasons.
I don't
have one either.
So that's a whole other tangent that we can go on. But I do wonder if it's more a commentary on like him just figuring out humanity than it is actually even about androids. Because like I said, we're just at a different time and we have mm-hmm. a closer perspective to that. Whereas he is also just working out so many very essential questions about what it means to be human.
I think it's, again, one of those that we don't have answers to, frustratingly Mm-mm. enough.
Yeah.
I think it's a very smart way to think about the book. So for what it's worth, I didn't think about it that way, but you are 100% right.
I don't know about that, but anyway.
Okay, well, I'll give you 75%.
Okay.
You're 75% right.
Yeah.
We'll open up some wiggle room there.
Okay. Did you see Blade Runner 2049?
I have not seen Blade Runner, the Hey Girl supercut. No, I have not.
Okay.
Is it good?
It is really good. Yeah.
Okay. How does it compare to the original Blade Runner?
Well, I don't think this is a spoiler to tell you that it does act as a sequel. Okay. So we are building off of the original story. And our Hey Girl is Ryan Gosling, guys. And he is also a bounty hunter. And his name is Kay, also known as Joe. But what we learn very immediately is that he himself is an android.
Oh.
So suddenly the story is kind of shifted to his perspective, and we're following him as someone who kills his own.
And it has precedent because the book kind of mentioned that idea and then quickly like moves past it.
Yeah. And I won't spoil it too much, but the conversation we had early about kids, about procreation, also becomes very complicated in a way that is of interest not only to law enforcement, but also to capitalists.
Oh, see, this is very interesting. I meant to watch it and I didn't. I kept falling asleep at like 9 o'clock at night on the sofa.
It's okay.
So I will add it to my queue for sure. Especially if you like it, you have excellent taste in movies.
I really liked it. I watched it at home and it made me wish that I watched it at the theater because it is a really striking film. And it went and won an Oscar for cinematography, which is not much to frown about.
No.
So anyway, I recommend it, everybody.
Yay. And if you've seen it, let us know what you thought about the movie and how you think it compares to the original Blade Runner. You can add us and we'd like to. Pixie can field those questions until I get with the program. So, but you guys did have a lot to say about this book. So we asked two questions and I think maybe we'll start with our second question first. Mm-hmm. We asked you guys basically what we were talking about earlier. If a robot or an android can reason, think, and feel, should it have rights? And you guys had a lot to say. So B at 799 Books said they should, but they never would. Humans would probably always conveniently dismiss the pain of other creatures when we find it convenient. How else could you justify farming of animals? We've simply decided their pain is less important than ours, and we'd do the same with androids.
Yeah. And I think that's what is so interesting in the book is that we have these dynamics between the animals and the androids. So that's a really good answer, B.
I did wonder what they ate.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are they all vegetarians?
In the book?
Yeah.
There isn't a lot of eating. There's that weird scene when Isidore is that his name?
Yeah. And he gets like peaches and rotten
peaches and the bean curd.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And wine out of his safe deposit box.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're like, well, are they eating like weird manufactured rations? Is it all Soylent Green at this point?
Maybe. I don't know.
Which I've never tried Soylent.
No.
I've meant to, but.
Why? You
know, part of me thinks it might kill me. It's just to try it.
Mm.
I mean, why do anything?
Yeah. I guess.
I'm going to have an existential crisis after we finish recording. I can already tell.
Well, our friend Daniel says, yes, absolutely. These androids were created to be very human, so I think it's a must. If they don't want them to have rights, then take away the feeling pain part, and maybe I'd think differently.
Oh, I think he introduces, like, a really interesting question, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's something about them feeling pain, whether it's emotional pain or physical pain, that makes us maybe identify with them a little more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
And then Kay at AKA Kiss Kiss said, when robots get to that level, there's more to worry about other than should they have rights. Skynet, call in John Connor and prepare for hashtag the Terminator.
We will have a lot to worry about. Let's be honest.
Very practical, Kay.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually a really good answer.
That is so good.
Thank you. And then the second question we asked you guys was actually about another kind of tech in the book that that we haven't talked about yet. They have a machine that as a human you can hook up to and you can dial in your mood. So you can change the way you feel for the day. And so the question we asked was, if you could change your mood or personality by turning a dial, would you?
Jamie at Jamie Reads Book says, I'd love to be able to change my mood, especially if I'm in a bad one, but I can also see how that could become problematic. It would make your feelings less authentic and also less meaningful. As someone who likes to listen to my gut and make decisions based on feelings, I'd no longer be able to trust my own perceptions. Definitely get it. Mm-hmm.
This question about, is it authentic if you program it into yourself?
Mm-hmm. That then, alone is a very complicated question. Like, what is an authentic feeling? And there are people who would argue that those of us who medicate in different ways are not feeling authentically.
I mean, those people are full of crap, but it is an argument.
It's an argument. Exactly.
So at Between Two Covers said, no way.
I have to admit that scene disturbed me. Like the way it starts off the book, I was like, oh, unsettled by it because I knew that that would be something that I would take advantage of, even though it seems kind of weird, especially when Rick, he dials in his wife to be basically submissive to him.
Yes. I was like, ooh, I don't like you at all.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, this is not a feminist book, right?
No, like, it is not.
It was written in 1968, but that doesn't mean we need to let it off the hook for that.
Well, and I remarked to my friend that I was talking to about Blade Runner 2049 that it seems like both of the movies, one of the themes is that human women are unlovable. So it's just worth putting out there.
It's almost like if you take away procreation, human women don't have a purpose.
It's almost like we might as well not be here.
Oh, gross.
Okay. A hat for every read says, I would. And then she also points out that in brief situations, you might feel really anxious, like something like a job interview. Changing your emotion would be a really good thing.
Like a temporary change, maybe.
A boost.
Rather than something more permanent.
Mm-hmm.
I hear that.
Yeah.
And here we go. At C'est la vie dans les livres. Oh, every time. I'm so sorry I slaughter your name. I don't mean to. Says, I think most of us feel like we are being controlled by our emotions, and it is difficult sometimes to change how we feel about certain situations. This might have some positive aspects. It could help people who suffer from anger to be able to express their anger more appropriately. But having a remote-controlled emotion will be heavily guided, I believe, by social norms. So, for example, this idea of being constantly happy is our new social norm, and as such, anger and sadness are looked at negatively. In fact, not knowing how to process these emotions naturally will lead to emotional distress, because when you are feeling really low, where are you going to get the willpower to change how you feel? So I'm not sure if it will give us more freedom or actually repress us.
It's deep.
Yeah. I mean, she brings up a point, right? And Deckard actually mentions this when his wife programs in a depression.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, how are you going to turn off your depression? You're not going to want to turn it off because you feel depressed, right?
Right.
And so, but she wants to feel something different, which of course you would. Mm-hmm. Like, if you felt happy all the time, that'd be exhausting. Well, on some level.
Absolutely. And it also just opens up this whole other can of worms, which is what's the purpose of emotion? Why do we value them? Are they real? Why do we have them? Why would we give them to androids? Just the whole purpose of them. And how much attention do they deserve?
Exactly. It's that last bit that I think is interesting for anyone who's ever been in talk therapy. So... We've talked about this before. I have anxiety, so I have a therapist. And one of the things she tells me all the time is, like, you are not your thoughts. And I'm like, how is that freaking possible?
Exactly.
You can feel an emotion without, she's like, you can acknowledge how you're feeling without engaging in it. And I'm like, also, what does that mean?
Right?
I'm Latin. I feel a lot.
Have a lot of feelings. Same. I had a friend who was deep in a 12-step program, and whenever I would get upset about something, he'd be like, it's just a feeling. it will pass. And I'm like, what is that supposed to mean? It's real. I'm having it.
They're not like kidney stones where it's like, oh, there it is. It's gone now. Like, they're in there somewhere. Like, has no one seen Inside Out?
I know. Like, that answer just would infuriate me sometimes. Other times I could be like, you're right. This will pass. But other times I'm like, no, it's not.
I know. I feel like we should have found a therapist to be our third person on this episode.
I think
because,
so.
Like, we're going to need one.
We're going to have to double
all
down.
These questions.
Yeah. Doubling down on therapy very soon. Oh my gosh.
Well, guys, thank you for participating in this week's or this month's discussion, because we definitely needed some outside perspective on this book. And you guys gave us some really, really, really good ones. So thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
So if you enjoyed this book, we have a couple of other recommendations for you. So my first book recommendation is iRobot by Isaac Asimov. And so this book is the book that gave us the three laws of robotics that have governed the creation of robotics for quite a long time. So I definitely recommend that you go read it if you want to learn more about some ideas that influence real world stuff.
Sounds good. I feel like a bit of a phony this week because I don't really know any good recommendations firsthand that I could give. I'm trying to be very honest when I say I don't know a whole lot about this genre. So some obvious choices would be Ready Player One, which obviously that is coming to theaters near you as a movie very soon. I've never read Ready Player One. That's on my list.
Waste your time. Oh, okay. Is it?
Yep.
Okay. Well, okay. Here's the thing about Ready Player One. And okay. Like, I'm sure we're going to lose 50% of our subscribers. And you know what? Y'all need to hear the truth.
Oh, no. Okay.
So it is a nostalgia trip. So if you were a kid in like the 80s, 90s, it is just like reference after reference after reference after reference, especially if you played video games, right? You're mm-hmm. like, oh my God, I recognize all that. And that is the fun of the book. The actual writing of it is abysmal. Like, it's just really poorly written. I was trying to be nice about it, but like, it's just bad. Is it Sean Penn bad? Maybe not quite, mm-hmm. but it's not, you know,
okay,
glowing. So read it for the like nostalgia, but don't approach it thinking that you're gonna get something just mm-hmm. stellar.
Okay, so maybe I don't recommend it.
No, you do recommend it. So anyway,
I'm not personally recommending any of these because I haven't read them.
Okay.
Another comp title, if you will, would be Neuromancer by William Gibson. Mm-hmm. That is sitting on my shelf waiting to be read. But once again, I haven't read it. We have a lot of friends who love William Gibson and Neal Stephenson. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So those would probably be a couple to track down if you're looking for more in this genre. As for television... I have lots of recommendations. I thought it would be kind of fun to go in and watch some old Battlestar Galactica this week while I was kind of getting psyched up for this episode. And it has been delightful to go in and watch some of that old stuff.
That's so smart.
I love Battlestar Galactica.
And yet you never reached out to the PhD in computer science, who's also an artist and also decently tall. And also could save you from the apocalypse.
Who could save me from the Cylons? Or also let me be rescued by them? Like, I know. I know. Lost opportunity.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
That's a great TV recommendation, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
One of our other listeners mentioned a TV show called Humans. And I wish I could think of their name, but I'll try and tag them in the episode. But
yeah.
I don't know anything about it. But she was like, this is 100%. You will be into it. So there's that. And of course, Westworld.
Ugh, Westworld.
If you are perfectly fine with your worldview, you don't want to get spun into an existential crisis about selfhood and like what it means to be alive, don't watch that show.
Yeah, don't.
Don't do it.
Yeah.
If you do want to have a moment, go watch that show and then join us in the second season as we freak the F out.
Yeah. I will say that so much of my reading of this book was influenced by having watched Westworld.
Agreed. Agreed.
So it would be interesting to have the opportunity to read it without having seen the show.
Yeah, I think so, because my feelings about the androids in Westworld are different.
Mm-hmm. Same.
Even though, obviously, this book is foundational to Westworld.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But yeah, Westworld is great. I think it's definitely worth watching. I actually think it's one of the best shows to have come out in quite a few years, mm-hmm. in my personal opinion.
Yeah, but, I love it.
I mean, that and The Good Place, so. And with that, we're done with this month's pick. So we get to introduce next month's pick.
I'm exhausted. This book really took it out of me.
Yes. I mean, I got halfway through it. I mean, we're toward the end of the episode, so all you long haulers are still here. But halfway through, I was like, what have we done to ourselves?
Yeah.
Like, why are we putting ourselves back in the same place that we only just got ourselves out of with like all these other existential books that we've read?
You know, we deserve what we get. But that's, you know, that's why we read.
It is.
It really is. We expand our horizons.
Yes, that's what we get for trying to be cheap and pick a shorty. Be like, we just want a short book this week.
Right.
And then it's like, oh my God, we might as well just pick the like New Testament or something.
It was a good one. I'm glad we read it. Even if I feel like we have said a whole lot of nothing this episode.
You can write us an email about it and tell us how off base we are on this one.
Right. Well,
and maybe if you have extra Prozac, put that in the mail. Give that to us too.
We'll take it. Anyway, our next book is a very hard left from this one.
And it is Ask Me About My Uterus by Abby Norman, which is a nonfiction book that just came out. Abby writes about her experience trying to solve a medical mystery. So she had been sick for a while and was experiencing quite a bit of pain. And basically, it's all about her journey to try and find a diagnosis.
This book was interesting to both me and Maria for a lot of reasons, but specifically, we're interested in the idea about pain and what it means, and even more specifically, women's pain and how it's stigmatized sometimes, how it's treated in modern medicine. And without getting too anecdote-y on you guys, I think we're both just kind of interested in it from a personal standpoint.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So. And so, you know, we kind of figured it had been a while since we'd done a real sort of overtly feminist book. I think the last one was probably N. Helen Peterson's Too Fat, Too Slutty, Too Loud.
Right.
Probably.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought we would throw another one in. We also think this is really, really timely. So women's bodies are a political, like, hot topic right now. As a matter of fact, Ohio just presented a bill that would make any abortion for any reason, illegal in their state. So clearly, women's pains and women's pain and women's bodies are still being legislated. And this is a book that I think might give us a little insight into women's experiences, but also maybe why this is the case.
Right. And I also hope that it's going to be empowering to especially our women listeners, but also our male listeners, who sometimes we're all challenged when it comes to believing women when they say things about their experiences, about the things that they're feeling. So I think it'll be good for us, but also I'm interested to read about the medical mystery. That's how it's framed. Yes. So I've heard it's a compelling book, and I'm really looking forward to it.
And the cover is basically flowers in the shape of a uterus. So how can you not love that? They're like little daisies as ovaries.
That's right.
Very cute.
Yay. So,
Pixie, I loved your Instagram story of the books that you checked out of the library.
Yeah. I checked out this book, Ask Me About My Uterus, alongside a book about Jack the Ripper. All in one go.
Who made it his personal business to extract uteruses from people's
right, bodies. Which that did not really occur to me when I was, you know, putting these on my hold list. And then when I picked them up at the library and had to check them out at once, only then did it occur to me how odd a coupling that was. But like I said, the librarian was perfectly nice about it. You know, he didn't act particularly concerned. I'm sure he sees a lot of weird stuff.
Oh, that's so funny. I think we have some Jack the Ripper stuff, like maybe a little bit of a side project cooking up about that.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll have some news about that later on in the summer. But yeah. And don't forget, make sure if you have suggestions for books for us to read, shoot us an email. You can reach us at misfitbookclubpodcast@gmail.com. And you can always hit us up on Twitter and on Instagram. So if you don't want to read about existential issues, about what it means to be human, or lady bits, you should probably give us your opinions. And we will absolutely listen to them and try and fit some of those books in. So
I would say that we absolutely want to do at least one reader recommendation, listener recommendation, yes, before the end of the year.
Oh, yeah.
So shoot us some ideas.
Anything goes. Also, if there's a book that like you think we'll hate and you want us to hate read it, I mean, ooh, Pixie and I are excellent at hate reading.
That's
things.
True.
We just haven't done it yet.
Mm-hmm.
Lord, like the this. Shade we can throw.
I love this idea. Okay, yeah. I'm issuing a challenge right now, guys. Send us a hate read.
I have two criteria. One, it can't have a dog on the cover, because I do not read books with dogs on the cover.
Absolutely not.
And two, it cannot be Ulysses by James Joyce, because I'm just never going to read that. They tried to make me do it twice in grad school, and both times I was like, no, I'm not going to do it. You can't make me.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, I'm paying you for my education, and I am not reading that book. So.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Definitely well, guys, not. Yeah, I think we're at the end. So thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. You can or Stitcher or Google Play or wherever you're listening to this podcast. And be sure to tell some people about us.
Marie and I are anonymous. These are not our real names. So we rely on word of mouth and all the fancy algorithms to help us so that other people can find the podcast. So rating and reviewing and telling your friends does a lot of good for us. If you want to reach out to us, you can through Twitter at Misfit Book Club, Insta at Misfit Book Club, Facebook Misfit Book Club, and you can email us misfitbookclubpodcast@gmail.com.
Yep. And remember, no more Goodreads discussion boards, but you can friend us on Goodreads. So we are still hanging out over there. And can I do a quick other podcast shout out?
Yeah.
Before we wrap this up?
Yeah.
I just want to say hey to the Brendan Fraser podcast, which is a new podcast that is being hosted by some of our listeners. And it is really good. They're doing such a good job with it. And honestly, it is making me kind of like fall in love with Brendan Fraser all over again.
I have got to listen to this. It sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it's really, really well done. I highly recommend it, especially if you are interested in Brendan Fraser or his movies at all.
How many of our younger listeners are like, who the hell is Brendan Fraser?
All of them?
He's a 90s guy, okay?
They're like, was he like an NSYNC? No. Stop it.
I'm so excited. I can't wait to listen to Brendan Fraser podcast.
I hope at some point in the run of this podcast, we can tell our story about riding the mummy ride at Universal Studios.
Multiple times.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was amazing. And anyway, but you'll just have to keep listening to see if we tell that story or not.
That's right.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for sticking around in this episode that actually got a lot deeper than I had originally thought it would get. Yeah. But I'm not surprised, really.
We did our best. Thank you guys for talking to us on social media, and thanks for listening.
Yeah. All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.